Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting.
One of the reasons I could take a little bit of time at the beginning there was because these are probably the easiest drugs to understand of all the drugs we'll talk about. Because of basically their, in essence, neurotransmitters. Okay. That's morphine. That's heroin. Basically, we're talking about anything like opium. Which the active ingredients in opium are morphine and codeine. That's what these are called, opiates, though. There's opiates, and those are the natural things, okay? And then there's opioids, or all of them, because some of these things you can build in a lab, some of them you build in your brain, and some of them you can just get out of, say, poppies, right? They're actually, they used to be called narcotic analgesics, which is really a great term. They put you to sleep, and they kill pain. There's a problem with that, and that's that the word narcotic has a legal meaning now, and that's no good because, for example, narcotics acts in various countries control substances like cocaine and marijuana and LSD, too, which are certainly not narcotics. So that term has kind of gone away, which is a shame. So we talk about opiates a lot more, or opioids. Because it seems kind of crazy to use a term that has two meanings. It really is a shame, though, because narcotic is a great word. It puts you to sleep. So there's natural ones, and there's man-made ones. The natural, the classic opium, comes from sap from poppy seeds, which is where you get morphine and codeine. The sort of mythical, traditional way that it is harvested would be that you would run, this supposedly, this almost certainly isn't true, but you never know in the ancient times, that I think Scythians, these ancient people, supposedly would run naked through poppy fields and the sap would get all over their bodies and they'd scrape it off and cook it down. Heroin is almost morphine. It's got two acetyl groups on it. It's diacetylmorphine. This is 10 times as lipid soluble as morphine. And as you know, lipid solubility is really important for absorption. So that's great, except diacetylmorphine can't fit through the blood-brain barrier. However, there is an enzyme that lops off one of the acetyl groups and you get acetylmorphine or monoacetylmorphine if you want to use sort of old terms. So it gets in, gets the blood-brain barrier, this enzyme lops off an acetyl group, gets in 10 times more quickly, but it actually simply is, it's just morphine basically. Yeah, Steph.
Does it partition into fat tissue and stay there?
Morphine?
Yeah, or heroin.
How do you mean? Oh, No, because what's going to happen typically is you're going to end up with it's going to get metabolized. Because it's so fast.
Okay.
Yeah, partially because it's so fast, but also it's metabolized really easily. This is so much like a neurotransmitter that we have that it's not like something. Not really. No, it's not like something that's going to get stored up like that, like, say, in PCBs or something like that. No. No. I mean, the molecular configuration of morphine and, like, enkephalins and endorphins are virtually identical. The nervous system can't tell the difference. So synthetics, methadone, is it sort of a classic synthetic opiate, LAHM, levofenol, phenazosine, and there's tons of other ones. These are almost always used for maintenance when people have a heroin problem. What these things tend to do is they tend to get rid of the withdrawal symptoms, but they don't cause too much of a high. So what's the fun in them? Well, it gets rid of the withdrawal symptoms for people. That said, they're still opiates, and they still can be dangerous. You got to understand that something that can put you to sleep can put you to, can slow you down to the point where you never wake up again. These are they tend to be longer lasting. They're designed that way, but they're also longer lasting because they're taken orally typically. They typically aren't injected, these drugs. Right? So what do you when you give somebody, when someone goes to a methadone clinic, they either take a pill, but usually it's not a pill, usually you drink it. Because you want it in their gut and you want slow absorption and you want it long lasting so people don't feel withdrawal symptoms all day. Right? And of course, people, when they take, that has to be taken in a clinic and it has to be taken under a doc, under, like, you have to actually take it usually in front of the pharmacist that's there or the MD or nurse or whoever. Depending on the jurisdiction, it can be also just given out as a prescription. I know, for example, in Quebec, it's given out by prescription, not just at methadone clinics, but by law, you have to consume the whole dose in front of the physician, and you sign a form, and he signs a form, and the whole thing. A little bit of history. Sumerians called it the joy plant. Good for them, the Sumerians. That's one of the first sort of people that stopped being hunter-gatherers. They already figured out it was fun. It was used extensively in classical medicine. I got that in quotes because, of course, no one knew what they were doing in medicine until about 1880. It was basically, it could be a series of trolls in your stomach. But, of course, see, the thing is, because it's an analgesic, it would be used a lot when people were in pain. And this was known way back in the day. This was known literally, like I say, classical medicine, that means the Greeks and the Romans. So they would use poppy sap when people were hurt. 1644, the Chinese emperor banned tobacco, so everyone switched to opium. Prohibition never, ever works, no matter what culture. It's one of those things. By the early 1800s, it was big in Britain. I got a little sort of sarcastically that they still do. There's much more heroin consumption in the UK than there is in North America. A little more widespread. I love this. In 1875, the UK consumption was 10 pounds per 1,000 people. That's a lot of opium. Morphine caught on when it was isolated, right? Because they figured opium's one thing. You smoke opium, basically. And you end up then releasing the morphine and the codeine. But then morphine is isolated, and now people are selling morphine. Of course, there was a temperance movement, because it always happens whenever something fun comes along, someone tells you to stop doing it. And then it turned out that the new drug dealers were physicians and pharmacists. So that's great. I think it's funny as hell. In the U.S., consumption was even higher, 13 pounds, around the same time. This was because of the Civil War in the States. Of course, morphine was isolated. They were using it now for battlefield surgery, things like that, which was really starting to happen, if you know a little bit of history, during the U.S. Civil War. Before that, and medicine was starting to work properly, too. But so, for example, for, amputations, things like that, they could pump a guy full of morphine, and he'd fall asleep, but also he wouldn't feel as much pain in the morning when he woke up and his leg was missing. So it was used a lot in battlefield medicine. Oh, by the way, before I get onto that, when I mentioned Britain, it was banned in Britain, right? Because they didn't want their public having it, but they were also selling it because they ran Afghanistan. And that's where a lot of the poppies in the world are grown, is Afghanistan, Turkey, around that area. So what happens is, the Brits say we can't be selling it in our own country, but we can still sell it to the Chinese, because they love it. The Chinese say, well, that's not fair. And the Brits say, yes, it is. We're going to have a war now. The UK, actually, Great Britain has a war against China. A non-technologically advanced power against the greatest power in the world at the time. And they fight them because they say, you must keep buying our opium. You know, you may think that it's bad about Iraq. Sure. But It's not like they're saying, now we're going to war because we want you people to eat more McDonald's. And you have to. And more trans fat. Right? That's literally, it's called the Opium Wars. That's where Hong Kong came from. Why do you think there's Hong Kong? Why was this little part of China that became, for 100 years, part of Britain? Because they beat China, as you would expect, a great power against a technologically not very advanced country. They beat them pretty badly. And they say, oh yeah, and we're taking this too, because we're going to sell the opium right out of this place here. Oh, not back home though. No, it's not for white people. It's really quite an interesting story. Where the hell do you think the Hong Kong Bank comes from? HSBC? There's a lot of big companies in Britain. And I'm so rarely say these things because I'm not one of them. They're the man and people should rise up and you have nothing to lose but your chains. But it's all true here. All right. Just an interesting little side note. IP injections are pretty much the best route to the brain. Or you can do IV injections. Oral administration is going to be much slower because you get through first-pass metabolism in the gut, right? And again, that's what you want when you are doing like methadone maintenance, things like that. And it's easy to keep it at a pretty constant level. It's also good for analgesia. So if you're not doing this to get high, you may take an opiate pill as a painkiller. OxyContin is a great example. It's a very good, powerful pain medication. And when you take it properly, it's a very good, powerful pain medication. But if you take a whole bunch of them, you get wasted. Or if you crush them up and you snort them. Right? Whole different thing. Crosses the blood-brain barrier, as I mentioned, with morphine. And also the placental barrier. And some of the metabolites are also psychoactive. If you take a look at how there's the protein that breaks down and forms endogenous morphine, endorphins, when it breaks down even, I'll talk about it in a second, it's beta-lipotropin, but when it gets broken down into an endorphin, it can actually get... It's not just in the endorphin that's there, but there's a whole bunch of others, other amino acids, not amino acids, peptides that get broken down, and they're also psychoactive. Same sort of idea. So, in fact, again, it was one of these things everybody knew we made our own. Heroin's faster because of the lipid solubility and it becoming monoacetylmorphine. Right? Going from diacetylmorphine, which doesn't pass through, to monoacetylmorphine. Yes, Stephanie.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to be allergic to morphine? Or maybe more so?
Wow, it seems exceedingly unlikely.
Someone reacted to it.
Oh, you might react to it, yeah. It's got a lot of potential.
Like they're trying to, the nurse is trying to inject it and it wouldn't want to go in.
That just seems weird. What do you mean it didn't want to go in?
Like their vein was turning all red and puffy.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe the needle was bad. How many times did the nurse try? Maybe she missed a vein or something like that. Yeah. It seems unlikely, because then you'd be allergic to parts of your own brain. And that seems pretty bad.
Do you know they used to, if they don't inject just straight morphine?
No, it could be the vehicle, but the vehicle would probably be saline. And you wouldn't be allergic to saline, because you'd be allergic to your own, everything.
Yeah.
You know, your eyes would be watering, and then the stuff that's watering out of your eyes, you'd be allergic to. I'm allergic to tears. That's basically saline, right? Seems unlikely. I guess it's possible, but you'd think that person would be dead by now just from having all the morphine in their body, because they're chemically almost identical. Even before the receptor was found, it was pretty clear that there was a receptor directly for this. The molecular configuration of various opiates was related to their effect, which is a good indication that they're opening different receptors, okay? Because that's how receptors work, lock and key, right? The key being the drug or the neurotransmitter or whatever, and the lock being the receptor. If the molecular formation, configuration rather, is related to the effect, it's a pretty good indication that if different keys must work in different locks. Unlike something like, you think about GABA, not GABA, what am I saying? It's like alcohol or nicotine. We don't really know how they work. There probably aren't receptors directly for them. They're acting kind of as modulators. This was like, oh, this is probably already a neurotransmitter. So there must be endorphins. That's what endogenous morphine. The receptor sites were discovered, and 6 months later, endorphins and enkephalins were discovered. So first thing that happened was they found the endorphins. I mentioned here, in the pituitary gland, beta-lipotropin, which is a polypeptide. It's a big, long one, too. It's this big. It's 50-odd amino acids. The last 31 are endorphin. But there's another one. So the last 31, I think it's 31. Yeah, the last 31 amino acids, they get broken off, and they become endorphin. There's other parts of beta-lipotropin that do things like control production of melanin, skin pigment, and eye pigment. So it does all kinds of things. Another thing is that there's other, when this thing, it's not metabolized in a sense, but when it's broken apart by enzymes, you end up with other psychoactive things. There's, I think, gamma enkephalin is another one that's there. So there's all kinds of things here that are endorphins in beta-lipotropin, but it does other things too. So they found this. They looked at what happens. They said, oh, hey, look, those last 31 amino acids just bound to that receptor site. I bet that's endorphin, and it is. Science is cool that way. And then when you look at that molecule and look at a morphine molecule, and it's like, oh, I'm looking at almost a mirror image. They're basically the same thing. Now, endorphins are found in vesicles in neurons, like in axons. And that, remember the five things they need to satisfy before something's a neurotransmitter? That's one of those really key indicators that you have a neurotransmitter. They interfere with norepinephrine, acetylcholine, and dopamine, so they can act as modulators of those systems, there is an endorphin system too, so they actually act as neurotransmitters. Opiate receptors, there are four types, or three or four, it depends. There's one site, one kind of receptor here I'm going to tell you about that isn't just for endorphins. The first one is the mu receptor. This is throughout the limbic system. The limbic system is, that's going to control things like, well, memory, hippocampus. Amygdala is what? Emotion. Okay? Well, I'll tell you later that morphine has a taming effect on rats. It also has memory effects. So it's not surprising that it works there. The thalamus and the locus coeruleus, we're talking here about all but sensory stuff. This is your router for your sensory system, your thalamus. This is for most of the sort of interesting effects, except for the high. So like the feeling of euphoria kind of feel. Like, oh, this is great, that kind of thing. But not the, because that, of course, is going to be your reward system. You know that's coming. These have what's called a weak attraction, these receptors, mu receptors, which means they have a great effect. You think, what? How does that work? Well, that's because it takes very little to make it fire. That's why it's weak attraction. It attracts just a little tiny bit of the molecule, and it'll actually open the receptor. Okay, the delta receptor. It's the limbic system too, but they don't overlap with the mu ones, so different parts. Also in the cortex, if you've ever seen somebody on morphine, they do have trouble thinking straight. And it's not just because they're going, oh yeah. It's also because they have trouble concentrating. Hypothalamus, I think you know that, or maybe you don't, but you may have seen people that after they go off morphine or heroin, if you've known anybody like that, they end up with goosebumps. It messes with your thermoregulation. Oh, look, the nucleus accumbens. There's a surprise. It's part of the reward system. The medulla, sleep and wakefulness, well, it does put you to sleep. Many antipsychotic drugs also work on delta receptors, which is kind of cool. We'll talk about antipsychotic drugs. So delta receptors aren't necessarily always only for opiates. The kappa receptor. This is, oh, look, it should say accumbens. The nucleus accumbens again. There's two classes. And the ventral tegmental area. So again, we got two parts of the reward circuit. The only thing we're missing here is the medial forebrain bundle. Hypothalamus, again, sleep and wakefulness. I'm sorry, thermoregulation and things like hunger and thirst. Thalamus, again, sensory stuff. This is your router for your, if you know about, like, if you have a router at home with, you have many computers on your network, the thalamus is basically like your router. All the sensory information passes through there. I started using that term when I used to say it's like a sensory switchboard, and people were like, what's a switchboard? And then I had to tell them about the TV show Mad Men, and then, but remember those people that are watching when they get the switchboard and they connect the calls? And I was like, no, I think it's better to just say it's a router, so I'm just going with that now. Or post office, that was another one I used to use. It's like a post office, except no one sends letters anymore. It's all the emails and that texting you kids do. Twittering. The sigma receptor as well is not just for opioids, and it can lead to psychotic symptoms. And they're kind of scattered around throughout the brain. This can lead to psychotic symptoms, so this is bad. The periaqueductal gray is full of opioid receptors, and when these are stimulated, when you get a pain message. So this is the pain-killing system, the periaqueductal gray. Okay? So again, just to summarize from before, the amygdala, that's emotion. Things like your respiratory center, that's things like medulla, because you're talking about sleep and wakefulness and sort of biological rhythms. Your cough and vomit centers, why do you think these things? You know, you ever had the codeine cough medicine? It's awesome. You stop having a cough very quickly. You know, take 2 teaspoons, cough's gone. Mistakenly read it and says take 2 tablespoons, which I've done, and you have a very interesting evening. You're not coughing anymore, but you're laying there going, I feel kind of weird. I'm having really weird, vivid dreams, too. I'm very drowsy yet. This is unpleasant. Cough's gone, though. Vomiting, if you've ever seen the movie Trainspotting, yeah. Just saying. It's a movie about people taking heroin. So people often, the first time they take heroin, will get a vomit urge. Then after that, actually, they don't so much. But then when they get withdrawal, they puke. They do lots of puking. So it's in the reward system. It's the big thing here. We know BTA and accumbens. As I said here, there has to be some good reason to put a needle in your arm. It feels good. And it feels good right away. Again, and heroin addicts aren't stupid. They know that they're going to pay for this. They know that tomorrow they're going to have diarrhea and they're going to be puking and they're going to feel like there's little red devil hot things poking at them and stuff. It's like, yeah, but this is going to feel good right now. You look like you never want to tell you the look on your face like, oh, God. But apparently, I've seen someone take heroin and the look on the person's face. And I asked the person later, like, what does it feel like? He says, it's like my whole body's having an orgasm for 45 minutes. They think, oh, well, maybe that'd be worth the pooping myself. You know, it's... can lead to nausea. Your pupils get constricted. It disrupts digestive coordination. It's a very fancy way of saying it's got the problem with the pooping. You're going to drop in sex hormones. But you don't need it because it feels like your whole body's having an orgasm. So everything's really pretty much fine. You get a decrease in REM, but very vivid daydreams. So not so much hallucinations, but you know like when you're daydreaming and you can kind of imagine yourself being flying a Viper in Battlestar Galactica? Maybe that's just me. It seems more real. You get the feeling of the rush. That's the body orgasm thing. Right? You can get psychiatric-like symptoms, so in other words, paranoia, things like that. Right? Ugly stuff. With rats, you get an increase in spontaneous motor activity with small doses, which, again, taming effect. Think about this. You've got an effect in amygdala. Amygdala is related to fear. It basically stops that from happening. Right? So it's like, yeah, I'll walk around a little bit more than I normally would. You give them too much, and they're just in the corner, just like freaking out. Because they've just had it, like, oh man, this is awesome. You get something really weird called spontaneous social behavior. Rats can be quite social, so they'll groom each other, things like that. So you'll actually get this, things where rats typically wouldn't do this if they don't know each other. The same litter and stuff like that, they'll do it. But if you put two rats on a table, they'll stay pretty far apart from each other. You do this after you've given them some morphine, they'll come to each other, start licking each other. Low doses, you get an increase in FI and a decrease in FR. This is, I keep putting does instead of doses or dose. Again, this is a timing effect. This is probably just something to do with the animal's biological, with its clock. Remember fixed interval again? That's the one where the animal's rewarded for the first response bar press usually. After a certain amount of time, the FR is after a certain number of responses. When you see these effects on FI and FR responding, you know it's something to do with the animal's clock. High doses, they both just go down because the rat's really wasted. I mean, that's always been my interpretation. It's like, well, now I think I'll quit and just enjoy myself right here. Monkeys and rats, well, in humans, but monkeys and rats will work for it. They'll actually push a bar to get morphine. And that means it's a reinforcer. It'll support behavior. If something's a reinforcer, well, it's not surprising it's a reinforcer when it operates directly on the reward system, right? They can discriminate morphine from, say, codeine. They have very similar effects, but rats and monkeys can discriminate the two. They know that this bar is for morphine and this bar is for codeine. But it'll generalize to other opiates. So let's say you teach the rat that if he pushes this bar, he's going to get morphine. Now you take him, you push this bar, in a new situation, you're going to get codeine. That generalizes. They don't miss a beat. This doesn't always happen, by the way. Like, depending on the kind of reward, you wouldn't get probably food and water, for example, don't generalize to each other for bar pressing. But these different opiates do. But that's not surprising. They're directly operating on the accumbens and the VTA. Tolerance develops quickly. This shouldn't surprise anybody. It's a neurotransmitter, man. So it's of course the space is going to be taken up for a while. That's why you get tolerance. The withdrawal is really unpleasant, and I say it's not as bad as, say, sleeping pills or martinis. And again, I'm talking about I don't mean like a little hangover. I mean the DTs. I mean like Barney on The Simpsons. You know, I mean you have to wake up in the morning and have a drink so you don't see the pink elephant and have the DTs. So it's bad, but it's not as bad. When I say not as bad, I mean it's not as long-lasting. When people are surveyed that have been addicted or have a problem with both of these things, say both barbiturates and heroin, their barbiturate withdrawal lasts longer. People report that's less pleasant because while it is exceedingly unpleasant to go through withdrawal from an opiate, the worst of it's over usually in 36 to 48 hours. The worst of it's over, and I mean things like the pooping and the puking and the hot flashes and things like that. That really, really horribly unpleasant stuff's over. Whereas for alcohol or for barbiturates, it can last days and days and days and days and days, weeks. Right? So people typically report it's not as bad. I'm not saying any of them are good. So the worst part of it's over, for some people as low as 6, I've got there. You often hear 30, But to be safe, 36 to 48 is probably the worst of it being over. What happens with withdrawal? People are restless. Well, usually you get the opposite effect to what the drug did. Well, if it's going to slow you down, you're going to get restless. People have hot flashes. Now, again, when you talk to people that have done heroin and gone through the withdrawal, these aren't like, you know, women that go through menopause and have hot flashes. They're not like that. These are like feeling burning things all over your body. Somebody once described it to me as it's like burning little fire devils walking all over you. That sounds a little unpleasant. Right? So it's not just like, oh boy, I'm feeling kind of warm. It's not that. Yeah, goosebumps. Which is why it's called cold turkey. It should be called cold goose, wouldn't you think? But anyway, cold turkey. Because people get all goosebumpy. Get jerky breathing. Again, before it slows your breathing down, now you're going to get like that. Yes, Steph?
Do you get the goosebumps and hot flashes simultaneously?
No, I don't think so.
That would probably really...
That'd be much more unpleasant.
Yeah.
Could be, though. That'd be even worse.
So jerky breathing, is that the same as Shane Stokes breathing?
I don't know what that means. No, it's because of what it actually physically did, making you slow your breathing down before. So it's doing exactly the opposite, that's all. Yep. Never heard that term before. I've learned something today. Thank you. You get the puking at Al, which again means the pooping. And in all honesty, if you do want to watch... unless you have friends that have heroin problems, if you want to get a feel for what this must be like, the movie Trainspotting is great because it's got a really, an amazing scene in it of withdrawal. The neat thing about Trainspotting too is it actually does show that people can live a reasonably normal life with a heroin problem. It also shows that people can get off of heroin. It also shows that people can, after a couple of days of going through withdrawal, be pretty much okay. It's also kind of funny. It's strangely funny. It's very dark humor. And there's the one scene, as soon as you see, if you're easily upset, like I am, if you get this movie, as soon as you see the scene with the baby, just fast forward. Just saying. It's upsetting. But it's a great movie. Kicking the habit, what's that mean? That's where the term comes from. Kicking the habit comes from the fact that when people are going through heroin withdrawal, they have jerky movements of their legs, involuntary movements. That's not what I'm doing now. Just moving my leg back and forth. Right? It's called kicking the habit. So we got kicking the habit, we got cold turkey, both from heroin. And morphine and other OxyContin would be the same way. Some interesting self-administration patterns. A chipper, or somebody who's chipping, is more usually of a casual user, usually thought of like that. It's like they're eating chips. Right? Now, the problem is sometimes you have people that used to be really heavy users, and they do this, and then it can lead to something really, a big relapse of having like a three-day all-you-can-eat buffet of OxyContin or something. A lot of people, this was found in UK especially, where opiate use was much more common than it is here. It's still not like it's the drug of choice, but it would be much more likely if we were sitting here in I don't know, let's pick a British city. Oh, how about Brighton? I didn't want to go with London. That a couple people in this room had done heroin before. It wouldn't be that big a deal. Much less likely here. There's this pattern that happens where people sort of just matured out of it. They did it in school. Then they got a job. It was like, God, I got to stop taking heroin all the time. And they just stop. They just grow up, basically. That's why it's called maturing out. It's like, oh, God, I got to stop treating myself like this. I got to get to work on time in the morning. I can't be pooping and puking all morning. When it's available to animals, they will titrate it. If it's, they'll keep their high going. Same thing happens with people, typically, too. If they have a whole lot, they'll be like, okay, I just want to get a sort of a maintenance buzz going on with this stuff. You can inject it, you can snort it, you can smoke it, etc. Monkeys will, as I said, they'll mainline morphine. Monkeys actually will work for directly having it in their vein. They'll push a bar and they go, oh yeah. Well, it could lead to a coma. It shouldn't surprise us. You're taking something that's slowing everything down. Well, maybe it slows you down too much. Makes a lot of sense. You certainly could take too much. There's a few reasons here. One of them is you can overdose because depending on how reliable your supplier is and how reasonable they are, they may actually be cutting it with something really bad, or they may just be cutting the heroin quite a bit. So it might be you're getting heroin and a whole bunch of other stuff that's pretty much inert and harmless. That could happen. And then someday you get some really pure stuff and you think, oh, this is how much I need. Oh, I just killed myself. Or it could be cut with something like, oh, I don't know, Ajax. You know, like cleanser. Which, because, you know, you are buying this stuff from criminals. Criminals tend to, you know, cheat and lie and steal. That's their job. So, yeah, Stephanie. Oh, no, exactly. I mean, the thing is, it depends on where you're getting it from. It's somebody, like I said, somebody reputable. Typically, people that are sort of drug dealers that want to, they have a business. It's a business. You got to realize that. And they want to be around for the long haul. They won't do this. They would cut it with something inert if they're cutting it. Now, almost everybody's going to do that because it's very expensive. So they'll cut it with something like, oh, I don't know, sugar, not usually sugar, maybe cornstarch or flour or, you know, almost anything like that. Something crystalline. But yeah, you could. There's stories of people, you know, with Ajax. And it's something which, of course, is really bad for you. You're very clean when you die, though. There could be a loss of tolerance, and that's that shooting gallery effect I think I've talked about, which is where people get used to taking it in one place, under one situation, and their body then gets ready for the heroin. Right? Because the CS, the conditioned stimulus, is the place where you go to take heroin. And the conditioned response ends up being, okay, heroin's coming, get ready. Right? Now, which is one of the ways that's what tolerance is, basically, right? Now, what happens if you go to somewhere else? Doesn't matter where. You take your heroin at a different place. You buy it from a different person, whatever. Your body doesn't have that conditioned stimulus anymore. So now you of the place where you normally do heroin. So you don't have the conditioned response. You get a loss of tolerance. And the same amount that you would take 3 days ago to get a real rush, today kills you. Right? One of the biggest problems here, I mean, and again, this stuff can be dangerous because you take too much, you fall asleep and you don't wake up. People will mix this with other respiratory depressants. Things like alcohol. Things like barbiturates, benzodiazepines. But you got to realize, very often people will be, you know, having a couple of beers while they're doing this. It's a very, very bad idea. Never mix your drugs, right? It's the one thing I want you to take away. I don't care what drugs you take, just don't mix them. It leads to constipation, because remember, the opposite was the diarrhea, so this is the other end of this. And people, of course, that if any of you here have had surgery and they had morphine or OxyContin, and I'm sure you don't want to talk about it, but most people get constipated. Does it lead to cancer? I got a question mark there because it's hard to know. It's hard to know because we've got situations here, again, of people that are long-time users. They tend to be doing something illegal. It's not people that, and who's already taking lots of morphine for very long, it tends to be cancer patients already anyway. Right. So, hard to say. One of the worst parts, I've heard a lot of people argue this, is actually the lifestyle. Let's think about heroin for a second. The lifestyle of a heroin addict. You buy it from Tony Soprano or the Hell's Angels. These are bad people. Right? These are people that will maybe kill you. You share needles when you're injecting, right? Sharing needles leads to hepatitis and AIDS and other things being easily transmitted. About 21% of IV drug users in the States are HIV positive. I have no reason to believe that's any different in Canada. Right? There's no reason to believe it's any different at all. Now think about now something that's a little more of a sort of poor man's heroin, OxyContin. OxyContin tends to be more the sort of petty criminal type, but where do they get it? They break in to drug stores and pharmacies. That's illegal. Breaking into places is bad for your health. You might end up going to jail. You start hanging around with criminals. You know? Again, so the lifestyle choices here that people are making, and again, these things are so reinforcing that people tend to forget to do things like eat and take care of themselves. There are reproductive effects. Well, first of all, there's sexual effects, so you have less sex drive, but also it can lead to birth defects. It shouldn't surprise us. Your sex hormones are dropping, as I said. Low birth weight babies. And, of course, the baby's born going through a very nasty kind of withdrawal, too. A very nasty kind of withdrawal. Because we've got something that crosses the placental barrier. And a baby that's born going through withdrawal symptoms then has a mother and probably, and if the father's around, a father that have, you know, take a lot of, you know, that's like, you got like four strikes against you already. It's a pretty bad scene. Babies that are born to mothers that do opiates tend to have more illnesses after birth as well. Told you this was quick. It's the easiest drug to understand in the world. Treatment here, well, there's good old willpower. You know, just stop it. It's probably the case that the majority of people that have opiate problems actually do get off of it because they just have to. That sort of maturing out thing. Synanon, which is like Alcoholics Anonymous, that kind of thing. It's like it's the 12-step kind of approach. Okay? You know, I've also heard of Narcotics Anonymous. It's standard 12-step stuff, right? Admit the higher power, yada, 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 and you're free. I think that's how it works. Isn't that all the steps? There's yada, 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 11 steps there, but still. And I think the higher power one's like step 4. So I yada, yada, 3, through and 4, and then the rest of them. It's not horribly effective. It's probably better than willpower. Same thing with AA. You know, it's one of these things where it probably helps some people. Hard to get data on groups that are anonymous. Right? When you call yourself something anonymous, it's not like you could call them up on the phone and say, yeah, you guys have a meeting. I was coming out as a thesis student in psychology. I'd like to pass out my questionnaires to a bunch of alcoholics and heroin addicts. They're going to say no. And then hopefully they'll say, do you know what the word anonymous means? Antagonist therapy, that's basically, you know, methadone maintenance, that kind of thing. Or naloxone. Yeah, that's not, what am I saying? That's not, antagonist therapy is giving naloxone, which is a morphine antagonist. Now, that sounds at first really reasonable, because what's naloxone do? We've talked about it before. It gums up the works. Eh? It binds the receptor site without opening the ion channel. The problem here is that as soon as you stop taking naloxone, you can take heroin again. Right? The difference, though, is when somebody's overdosing, when someone shows up at the hospital and they're OD, they've OD'd, it looks like, on OxyContin or heroin or methadone, they're given naloxone right away because it's going to stop any other opiate that's in the system from binding to those binding sites. Maintenance is an interesting approach. There's methadone maintenance and LAM, which is a big long thing. It stands for some drug. Both of these two involve giving an opiate orally that basically controls the withdrawal symptoms but doesn't give you a high, or not very much of one. Not very much of one. The British have an interesting system. The British system involves you sign up as a, you register as a heroin addict. Right? So you go and you say, I'm a heroin addict. And a doctor has, like an MD, has to actually sign off on this. Now you can get your heroin. You can only get it in the hospital or a clinic. It's administered by a nurse or an MD. And you have to sit there in a waiting room and take your heroin. It's injected in you. Basically, this does a couple of things. You know it's safe. Nobody's sharing any needles. Right? You're not buying it from Tony Soprano anymore. You're buying it from the National Health. So all that's good stuff. It also takes out the sort of glamour of it. It's like you're sick. So psychologically, and I don't know that this was done on purpose, but people that have been through this system say that, you know, it used to be kind of fun. You know, you'd go out to a party. Maybe you're at home or whatever, but at least, you know, here I have to stand in line. It's given to me by a doctor, and I'm told to sit over there until my high's gone. It's like I'm sick. It's kind of a neat approach, and this is the idea of harm reduction, right? The harm reduction approach to drug treatment. The idea here is that people are going to take drugs. They just are. This is, I'm not saying this personally, I'm saying this is the approach of harm reduction. People are going to take drugs. So instead of making everything a crime and all this, and it's still illegal, but instead of that, why don't we take people with the worst problems and give them a safe place to shoot up, basically, and have it done, in this case, through a medical authority, right? They're in a safe place. They don't have to buy it from biker gangs and the mafia. The neat thing is that actually works. You have fewer people on the street. Right? This is the argument that's happening right now at the safe injection site in Vancouver, right? This is this idea the government doesn't like it on... it's probably moral grounds, I would think, is what their argument is. They say it doesn't work and all this stuff, except that I'm thinking that the, you know, whoever the minister is in charge of this, if they actually read any of the papers, would realize these things actually do work, these harm reduction approaches. You get fewer problems in the streets, and you actually get people eventually stopping from doing the drugs. So instead of saying we're just going to say no to drugs, instead of that, you say, yeah, we know there's drugs. Let's make sure you don't end up getting AIDS and don't get in a lot of fights and don't get, you know, knifed by a guy because you didn't give him quite enough money for the heroin.
Right?
And that's, of course, yeah, that's the other thing, too. I mean, it takes away the incentive for Tony Soprano to sell it, right? So the idea here is it's something illegal, but it's going to be around, so let's just make it safe. Right? And it, like I said, the data show that there are fewer social problems, right, when the harm reduction approach is used. There are some people that no matter how much treatment you give them, they will always have a drug problem. I don't know why that is. We should find out why that is. They're hard to study because they tend to be homeless, right? Because if all you do is drugs, you start having a job and things like that. So, you know, it's a hard population to track. So instead of criminalizing them and putting them in jail where they're going to get drugs anyway. I heard a report on CBC just the other day about, you know, in Kingston, you know, a maximum security penitentiary where they put the really bad people, they just broke up a heroin ring. People's families were mailing them heroin, and then they were selling it in the prison. I mean, you know, and, oh, guards were bringing it in, too. There's bad people everywhere, and there's a lot of them in prisons. That's where we put bad people. So it's something that seems like it works. It's totally counterintuitive, and in fact, in a lot of you, you're thinking probably, yeah, but it just seems wrong. But the thing is, the data show it works. Now you get less crime, etc. So it's an interesting system they have. It's been tried actually in Switzerland too, but I believe it was they got rid of it in Switzerland. They had it for a while. They got rid of it. They were a little more lax about it. And so you have to be very regulated about this. You come in, you sit here, you do your drugs, and then you can leave when you're not high anymore. You've got to be really careful that way. And I think if I remember correctly, the Swiss weren't that careful about it. Which is odd for the Swiss. They're very precise people. Questions about that or comments? Yeah, please.
What are kind of the giveaways of someone taking oxycodone? Are there any?
Think about those symptoms. They're going to be pupils constricted. They're oftentimes going to look like they're high, but sleepy. Okay. And when they're not taking it, you're going to see the withdrawal symptoms. You're going to see really weird shifts in, oh, it's very cold, oh, God, it's hot, it's goosebumps, that kind of thing. A lot of vomiting, a lot of diarrhea, stuff like that. Also, I mean, think of other behavioral things. If they're taking OxyContin, they got to get it from somewhere. So think of behavioral things like just, you know, who they're hanging out with, what part of town are they spending a lot of time in. They have a lot of really weird unexplained absences where they come back really happy. Stuff like that. Usually people aren't, but it's possible. You know, the thing about OxyContin, people are all up in arms about it, but it's just because it's a really good opiate. It's a great painkiller. We didn't outlaw morphine. And in fact, with heroin, while it's illegal in the States, you can't even do research on heroin. In Canada, you can, but the RCMP come to your lab every week and measure how much heroin you have. But you know, now heroin's being used in palliative care units in hospitals using something called the Brompton mixture, the Brompton cocktail, and they put a bit of heroin and some brandy. And it's enough that it's measured out, they know what they're doing, and it's enough that people can drink it and it kills their pain. And I've heard people get all up in arms about this, but you're giving him an addictive drug and it's like, I'm sorry, the guy's got bone cancer, he'll be dead in 3 weeks. I don't think he gives a crap. You know, I remember when my dad was dying of a brain tumor and, you know, I thought to myself, well, at least he gets to have morphine. At least he can have a bit of a good time now and then. You know. Are there questions about this? All right. Easiest one to understand of all of them. Well, maybe even antipsychotics are easier. They block dopamine. I guess that's the end of that lecture, too. All right. Thanks, guys. We'll be right back.
podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, Sharealike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me, because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.